Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Always a pleasure to have you here with me, or me with you, depending on how you think about that. All right, our goal here on Connecting Faith is to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus, to bring the mind of Christ to apply on the headline news of the day. And so I'm wondering if you've ever wondered, when you read the headlines, who organizes those efforts to defend Christians when their faith is attacked, or who organizes to defend college students when their freedom of speech is limited on campus, or who organizes efforts to help those pro-life pregnancy centers, on and on and on. Well, one of the people who makes all of that happen is Jeremy Tedesco. He serves as senior counsel and vice president of U.S. Advocacy and Administration for the Alliance Defending Freedom. He and I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I want to share that with you now. The subject of our opening part of the conversation is about Jack Phillips and the situation in Colorado.
It's really amazing what the state of Colorado has done. So less than a month after losing before the Supreme Court and being told that they cannot be hostile to Jack Phillips and his faith, they're targeting Jack again. They found probable cause against him again, this time over his decision to decline to create a cake that was pink and blue that celebrated
pink on the inside and blue on the outside.
Right. Mm-hmm. Celebrating a man's transition from male to female. And Jack said, I'm sorry, I can't create that cake because of my faith. I'll sell you anything else in my shop, create any other kind of cake for you, but I can't do that cake. And so amazingly, the state of Colorado has decided less than, again, a month after the court ruled that it had discriminated against Jack based on his religious beliefs, is targeting him for his religious convictions again. And so Jack and his family, look, they've been through 5+ years of very difficult legal battle. They lost 40% of their business. They have been harassed. They've received unbelievable, vile and hateful messages routinely at their shop. They've had death threats. They just want to move on with their life. They won their case at the Supreme Court, but Colorado didn't get the message. And so we are actually going to file a lawsuit against the state of Colorado to try to prevent them from even continuing this new prosecution against Jack. Because if Colorado's not going to heed the Supreme Court, we're going to have to take additional actions than just defending him in the state's tribunal. We're going to have to go to federal court and ask the federal court to stop the state from continuing this prosecution.
Okay, friends, my conversation partner today is Jeremy Tedesco, senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. You can check out the story that we're talking about right now and other related cases at adflegal.org. It's also the place that you can go if you're saying to yourself, hey, I know a guy who, or I know someone who is experiencing this kind of hostility toward them as a person of faith, simply trying to live out the full freedom and full expression of their religious convictions in the marketplace of ideas today. You can go to adflegal.org and you can actually connect with them about what's happening in your community, because this is how these stories and then cases actually rise, is that people who know what's happening out there in the world, in your one square inch of the universe, you have to actually raise the awareness of others that things are happening. So you can do that at adflegal.org. I wanna ask a definitional question for people. We hear the term animus. Can you explain to us what that means?
It means acting with the intent to hurt someone because of some aspect about them that you disagree with. So when you typically hear about animus, it's animus on the basis of, say, a protected characteristic like religion. And so when you target somebody intentionally because of a protected characteristic, that's typically what animus is. And so interestingly enough, that's what Colorado's guilty of in Jack Phillips' case. They are targeting him because of his religious convictions. The Supreme Court in Masterpiece, I mean, that was what they were primarily concerned with in that opinion, was the open hostility and targeting of Jack Phillips. But there's other aspects of that case that people should be aware of, too. Lots of times you'll hear commentators on this case, especially those who oppose the outcome, say it was a very narrow decision. And if Colorado just cleans up its act and doesn't say openly hostile things about Jack's or someone else's religious beliefs, that they can do to Jack what they wanted to do to him, force him to create artistic creations that violated his beliefs. And it's simply not the case, because the court also talked about the selective enforcement of the law in that case and how those who support same-sex marriage weren't required by the state to create expression criticizing same-sex marriage. But Jack Phillips, who opposes same-sex marriage, was forced to create expression celebrating it. And so the state's uneven enforcement of the law, their favoritism of people's First Amendment rights, saying we're going to give those who support same-sex marriage their full First Amendment rights, but we're going to take it away from people who oppose same-sex marriage, was also a huge problem for the court. They said that was another piece of evidence in the case that showed the state of Colorado's hostility towards Jack's faith. So the case and the decision in the case provides very broad-ranging protection for people on the basis of their religious convictions regarding any issue that you're motivated by when it comes to religion, but specifically on same-sex marriage. And I think another thing that not to miss about the case is how the court again reaffirmed, like it did when it decided the same-sex marriage case a few years ago, that people who believe that marriage is between a man and a woman hold good and decent and honorable beliefs that should be respected and tolerated. And the state of Colorado completely failed in that regard by punishing Jack because of those beliefs.
So there's one more part of this that I think would be helpful to have you talk about with us today, because every time we say the state of Colorado, you know, there's people listening who are like, okay, well, what does that mean when we refer to the state of Colorado? And so we're specifically referring to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Now, that sounds on the face of it like a really good and honorable, important thing. But the state of Colorado is not the only state or entity that has a so-called civil rights commission that is acting or operating in ways that you and I would say would like shake our heads from side to side and say that that's very selective use of the terms. So can you help us understand who creates such a thing, who oversees such a thing, and who then, you know, could disband such a thing if such a group of people in such a particular position of authority and power in a particular state are behaving in this way?
Yeah, I mean, these civil rights commissions are everywhere. They're part of the great administrative state that has grown up in the latter half of the 20th century and into the 21st century. And they have very broad and largely unaccountable power to pursue people when complaints of discrimination are filed against them. And they often, unfortunately, are activists, like we saw in Colorado. Colorado is not the only civil rights commission or human rights commission. They have all different kinds of names, usually sound very innocuous or even, like you said, a good thing for society. But they're often not in the way they act. They act very politically. And so they are often appointed people. They're not elected. They're often appointed because they have because they're social justice warriors who want to stamp out things in society that they think are wrong. The problem is, for instance, in Jack Phillips' case, well, when people think that your expression is bad or should be punished or silenced, they run up against the First Amendment, the free exercise and the free speech protection specifically. So these commissions are made up of people that largely have no idea of what the First Amendment means, what kind of protections it provides, and they're non-attorneys, so they don't really understand what the First Amendment even means when they're told, well, there's First Amendment protections involved in this case. And so undoing these commissions and finding a way to disband them, that's a tough question. I think that's a legislative question. And I think what we need to do is continue to raise the problems with these commissions, continue to show legislators and society as a whole when these civil rights commissions are acting in an activist way. It's really an education thing at this point. One of the scary things about these commissions is they have dual power. So they both prosecute you and they sit in judgment of you. They're judge and prosecutor. And in America, we typically well, we never mix those two powers because they can be abused. And so that's one of the most concerning things about them is the very person that's prosecuting you is also deciding whether you win or lose your case. And while they try to, you know, kind of divide up the powers and, you know, the commission will maybe have a division that does the prosecution while another division does the judging, it's all ultimately under the same authority. And that's a scary thing. We don't mix power in the United States. That's why we have separate branches, why we have separate powers in all the different branches of the federal government. And so we'd certainly like to see these commissions brought to heel.
Okay, friends, so we're going to continue to discuss and follow developments in what we thought was a resolved case, which is the Masterpiece Cake issue. And we will continue to follow this along with ADF at adflegal.org. I got to take a quick break. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Hey friends, welcome back. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. My conversation partner today is Jeremy Tedesco. Jeremy is a senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom. You can check out what we're talking about at adflegal.org. Jeremy, again, thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith. So we've talked about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Let's talk now about the NIFLA versus Becerra case. And so for those who, you know, aren't paying attention every single day to what the Supreme Court is doing or what the acronyms might be, tell us, introduce us to the NIFLA case and then go ahead and give us the outcome.
Sure. NIFLA actually is a organization that has a bunch of different pro-life pregnancy centers that are members of NIFLA. And NIFLA filed a lawsuit against the state of California. What California did was force all of NIFLA's members in California to promote abortion. And so you've got pro-life pregnancy centers that exist for the sole reason to stop people from choosing abortion, to encourage women in difficult circumstances facing pregnancies that they didn't know they were going to face, to choose life, being told by the state that they have to promote abortion on the walls of their facilities and in the materials they hand women who come to them for care. And so we took that case, filed it in state court a few years ago. It made it all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and we got a great victory in June, a 5-4 decision, finding that the California law violated the First Amendment. And the court's essential holding is you can't force people to promote ideas that violate their core convictions, especially when you're dealing with deeply divisive issues like abortion. But the state of California, you know, brushed that aside and said, no, not only are we going to force people to express this message about abortion and tell women who come to facilities where they can access abortion, but we're going to narrow the law so it really only impacts pro-life pregnancy centers. And so it was a targeted law against pro-life pregnancy centers and forcing them to express an idea that was diametrically opposed to the very reason they exist.
And so, again, with that victory at the Supreme Court, have we arrived at a place where the state of California and others have sort of recognized, okay, pro-life pregnancy centers not only have a right to exist, we can't compel them to do that which is contrary to their conscience. Let's leave them alone and let them thrive. I mean, has that been the experience thus far following the NIFLA decision?
No, and it never will be. The pro-life pregnancy centers have an unbelievable arsenal arrayed against them, from Planned Parenthood to NARAL to friendly states like the state of California, who will always be thinking of what's the next way that we can hamper, disband, frustrate the purposes of these groups. And so if there's one thing I've learned doing this for 14 years, it is that our opponents never rest, so we can't ever rest. And they're always looking for another way to limit our effectiveness or silence our speech or undermine the reason that we exist. And so the pro-life community especially has Planned Parenthood against them, NARAL and other pro-abortion groups that have unbelievable resources, power. They have federal tax money, friends at the highest places of government. Indeed, they could even convince the California legislature to pass a law targeting just pro-life pregnancy centers and force them to send women to Planned Parenthood facilities for abortions. And so we just need to understand as Christians that we live in a fallen world, and these battles will be with us all the days that we're here. And we just have to be eternally vigilant and understand that if we don't protect our freedoms and pass those freedoms to the next generation won't have them. And we have to teach the next generation that they have the same responsibility to stand vigilant.
So people who are listening are right now, I guarantee you, they are praying a verse of scripture that you would never grow weary in the good that you're doing, right? That's happening right now. Prayers are rising as people are listening to this. There are also those who see not only what you're doing, but the very fact that the organization that you serve with exists as an expression of hate. And so because you stand up for the free speech and the religious liberty of people who hold convictions that are pro-life or pro-traditional marriage or pro the biblical understanding of gender or gendered categories, let's say, you are then sometimes labeled as a hate group. And the organization labeling you in that way, applying that label to you, is called the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. Can you help our listeners? Because again, that sounds on the face of it like a good thing. So can you tell our listeners who might remember the Southern Poverty Law Center as the really important organization that took a stand against the KKK generations ago? But that's not what they're doing now. And so can you just help us understand the context of the hate conversation and how ADF is finding its way in that?
Sure. Yeah, there's so much to unpack here. But the Southern Poverty Law Center, you're right. They did good work many, many years ago now. And people know their name because they built their brand as a trusted monitor of hate groups. They made their name going after the KKK and ultimately shutting down most of the KKK back in the 70s and early 80s. But recently, and it's really not that recent, criticism has been coming towards them for decades now, literally 20 plus years. But especially in the last 2 or 3 years, they've really just turned into a partisan progressive hit operation. They have completely moved to the far left on all social issues, from immigration to life to marriage. And anybody who stands up, like Alliance Defending Freedom does, for religious freedom and free speech rights in those contexts and promotes and supports the right of people to offer different viewpoints than the far left viewpoint on those issues, the Southern Poverty Law Center is starting to label those groups as hate groups, as they've done to ADF. And look, there's been articles over the last 2 years, there's probably been 15 or 20 articles written, not just from the right. I mean, left-leaning publications, mainstream middle-line publications, right-leaning publications are all raising the alarm on Southern Poverty Law Center and saying they wield so much credibility in our society, but they utterly lack credibility because they just go after people whose views they disagree with now. And you know, I think one of the things that we need to think about is how important I think right now in our society it is to have polite civil discourse, to understand how to respect and tolerate people's views who we disagree with. One of the things that makes our country so great is our commitment to the civil discourse, to the search for truth, to respecting and permitting people who we disagree with, perhaps vehemently, to still have their right to express their point of view. And what the Southern Poverty Law Center does is shut down debate immediately because they just throw the hate label at people, and the hate label is powerful. And once people realize, oh, well, this is a hate group, I can just dismiss their views. Well, that shuts down debate. It's not good for our country, especially right now. We need to encourage civil discourse and free exchange of ideas. And they're working contrary to that in a way that's really going to negatively impact our society.
So again, friends, my conversation partner is Jeremy Tedesco, senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. You can check out what we're talking about today at adflegal.org. Jeremy, maybe one more question. And again, thank you for being so gracious with your time today. When folks are experiencing the kinds of things that we've been talking about, how do they sort of go through the decision-making process of when to reach out for help and to whom to do that?
Sure. I'll put on my attorney hat now.
That'd be great. Very quickly then acknowledging that nothing we are doing here today should be in any way, shape, or form construed as legal opinion or advice. Because I'm Carmen, and you guys know mostly I just talk.
At the first sign of trouble, you should call for help. That's the way I look at it. Because there's so many things you can do between the first sign of trouble and calling us that you need help with. You need to understand the lay of the land. What exactly are my risks? How should I, you know, position this and present this? And so the best thing to do is at the first sign of trouble to call us. And, you know, what I see too often, because I work so much with creative professionals in the wedding industry, is the first sign of trouble, they give up. They walk away, and lots of times they're walking away from their God-given calling, artistic talents. They're in the creative professions and working in the wedding industry because they want to do what God called them to do with the skills he gave them and celebrate something that's incredibly special to the Christian faith, which is marriage. And at the first sign of trouble, they get a request that maybe they don't want to participate in or create the expression for. They'll walk away from their God-given talents. They'll walk away from celebrating marriage. Those are voices that are lost that we need in our culture. And so, you know, I would encourage people to stand up like Jack Phillips did, like Baronelle Stutzman has done, like the wonderful folks who run pro-life pregnancy centers.
We've had Heidi Madsky and Kevin Terrio on the show to talk about that. So, yeah, people will recognize her name.
Yeah, and like Heidi Madsky for sure. And those people, look, we can't. Our rights can't be protected if people don't stand in the gap and say, I'll be accountable and I will stand and say, draw a line in the sand and say, you can't push me around. I have these freedoms and whatever comes, I'll stand to protect them. And that's when Alliance Defending Freedom and our, you know, powerful array of allies and friends can come along beside you and behind you and help you. Ultimately, as we've seen, win cases at the United States Supreme Court that will have impact for generations to come when it comes to protecting religious freedom.
So my encouragement to listeners today would be that if you're feeling a little bit like the prophet Isaiah and you're like, I am all alone, there are God has 7,000 out here who are willing to come alongside and stand with you. And so Jeremy Tedesco, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Friends who are listening, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I have been looking forward to today's conversation with Jenny Dyer for a number of months. There are people living in your community doing extraordinary things that you may not even know are out there or what they're doing. Jenny Dyer is one of those people in my community. And because what she does is actually global, she's technically in your community too. And so I wanted to introduce you to Jenny today, and I want to introduce you to the organization that she serves. It's called Hope Through Healing Hands. Hope Through Healing Hands is a nonprofit whose mission is to promote an improved quality of life for citizens and communities around the world using health as a currency for peace. So Jenny, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen, and thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. So, friends, you can check out what we're talking about today at hopethroughhealinghands.org. They also have a Facebook page by that same name. So, Jenny, let's just start off with sort of the status of women and children around the world. When we talk about vulnerable people, around the world, we're certainly talking about moms and kids. So just sort of give us a context for understanding this conversation.
Absolutely. And thanks for raising this. You know, I like to start with the good news. You know, a lot of times you get on these kinds of discussions and you start with the bad news, but it's better to start with the good news because our generation has done a historic and epic job at saving the lives of mothers and children, which are the most vulnerable amongst the world's poorest around the world, particularly in developing nations. But just to let your listeners know, over the last 25 years, so back to about 1990, our statistics show that we have been able to cut in half the number of deaths of those mothers who have died in relation to pregnancy, complications of pregnancy or childbirth. So it was in 1990, the number was around 600,000 women. Today it's about 300,000. Of course, that is way too many, the 300,000 lives per year. And of those, about 80% of those deaths are treatable and preventable. But we have been able to cut those in half. We've also been able to cut in half the number of children who die, that is children between the ages of 0 and 5, over the last 25 years. In 1990, about 12 million children were dying every year, and they were dying for just the most minute of causes, you know, that we would think in the United States, a death by a mosquito bite, they would get malaria, death by diarrhea, frankly, they didn't have access to oral rehydration, and death by pneumonia, they'd catch a cold. Those are the three leading causes of death for children under the age of 5. But today, less than 6 million children are dying due to these causes and others. So we've really been able, just in our generation, to tackle head-on the leading causes of deaths for mothers and children, but we've got to keep up the momentum. We're halfway there. We know how to solve these problems. We know how to provide care and help and to save lives, but we just need the will to do so. So that's where I'd like to start.
Okay, so absolutely. So I think there's probably people listening who are like stunned to learn that the three leading causes of death for children under the age of 5 are things as simple as a mosquito bite or catching a cold or getting diarrhea.
Yeah. I
guarantee.
Those are the...
So let's, I mean, you know, for my listeners, man, that's the sort of a sobering moment of a reality check. So now that we've had that reality check, tell us, you know, give us kind of the status in terms of current numbers related to maternal health, what these women want in terms of help. And, you know, because I think that sometimes as like first world people, we sort of imagine then, well, then what everybody wants then is this, this, and this. You know, they want DEET. No, they don't actually want DEET. So tell us what they're asking for.
Yeah, so when you poll women around the world, they really want a couple of things. One, they're very concerned about vaccines for their children, vaccines for the pneumococcal virus to combat pneumonia, for instance. They want this for their children. But they also want access for resources in order to healthily time and space their pregnancies. They know that they can't have 6 children or 8 children because they can't feed them all. They can't send them all to school. They can't provide shelter for all of them. And they need to have a smaller number of children, frankly. And so they need access and the knowledge to do so. So when polled, over 220 million women around the world have asked for this access to contraceptives, frankly, or access to the knowledge for Catholic women. For instance, there's lots of Catholic women in Central and South America who would prefer a non-hormonal method. It's not really the rhythm method, but they use these things called cycle beads, and they watch their cycle that way and are able to better time and space their pregnancies. And for women in the developing world, these are women, you have to remember, they live on less than $1 a day, many of them, $2 a day. these women, it's a life-saving mechanism. This is really a pro-life issue for them. For instance, over half the women in Ethiopia, is a good example, are married by the age of 16. But if they could debut that first pregnancy by 20, they're 5 times more likely to survive the pregnancy and childbirth themselves than if they were to get pregnant at 16 or below 15. So it's a huge lifesaver for them, but it's also a lifesaver for the child. If they're able to space those pregnancies just 3 years apart, the newborn in that first year of life is twice as likely to survive. So not only is it dealing with maternal mortality issues, it's also dealing with infant mortality issues. It's easy as going down to a drugstore in the United States, but it's not so easy for millions and millions of women around the world. So that is one of the key factors in providing global health care for women and children to save lives.
So I'll just admit to you, Jenny, and let me remind our listeners, my conversation partner today is Jenny Dyer. The organization that she serves is called Hope Through Healing Hands. You can find it at hopethroughhealinghands.org and on Twitter at HTHHGlobal. It sounds to me, Jenny, like what you're talking about is a justice issue. And when we talk about justice issues, sometimes as evangelical Christians, we get a little bit uncomfortable. When we talk about the spacing and timing of pregnancies and we talk about contraceptives, sometimes people get uncomfortable. But what we're talking about are really things that here in America are easily accessible, and we actually have an expectation, are a part of our ability to, you know, govern as much of our own lives as God gives us stewardship to govern. I mean, I'm not talking here about autonomy. I'm talking here about, you know, sort of a stewardship over my own life and my own resources in such a way that not only can I flourish, but my family can flourish, and therefore my community can flourish, and therefore my nation can flourish. And so I think when we're having these justice conversations, there's a little bit of looking in the mirror for, frankly, first world Christians and saying, you know, don't I want my neighbor halfway around the world to have access to the same things that I have access to as just a part of where I live?
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely a justice issue. And you know, this is an issue. It's a life and death issue for mothers and children around the world. So it becomes very black and white, if you will, when you think about women and children in the developing world and why they need access to the knowledge and to the resources to better time and space their children. It's as simple as a life and death issue, but it's as complicated as an economic issue as well. You know, countries that are able to provide this kind of education for women and to be able to plan their children better are also the countries that are able to lift themselves out of poverty, studies have shown over the last 50 years. So, you know, these issues trickle into much larger issues, national security issues, economic issues, public health issues, but also these are very basic anecdotal life and death issues that are presented in the Mother and Child Project, which was a book we did a couple years ago. The foreword's by Kay Warren, who is one of the co-founders of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, and the preface was by Melinda Gates, and we have a host of evangelicals who've written for the book of their experiences, and we also have women themselves from all over the world writing about why healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies has been a critical life-saving tool for them.
So let's talk a little bit about the book, The Mother and Child Project. You mentioned that the foreword is by Kay Warren. Certainly, listeners to Connecting Faith know who she is and have heard her talk about issues related to her own family and her concerns about mental health. But maybe, you know, friends, you haven't read Kay Warren's concern about for mothers and children around the world. Maybe you've never read Amy Grant's reflections or Michael Gerson. There's names in here. There's authors in here: Scott Sauls, Michael W. Smith, Natalie Grant, Christine Kane, Bruce Wilkinson, Dan Hazeltine. There are people throughout this book whose names you're going to recognize, and you're going to say, "Hey, I didn't know that that's a person who has this shared concern about these issues around the world. This is one of the things I love about what you're doing, Jenny, because you guys, you're not just hoping for a government solution. You're not just banking on one particular church doing all the work. You guys are actually working to lift up networks of people across all kinds of different, I don't know, categories, groups, in order to bring sort of a collective effort to bear. So talk with us about that. Talk with folks about sort of how Hope Through Healing Hands works in terms of lifting up people to advocate for things.
Absolutely. So really at the heart of what we do, or what I've done even for the last 16 years, is work with the faith community across the U.S. to, as the subtitle of the book suggests, raise our voices for health and hope. And advocacy is one of those things that I think is very overlooked in the church and by most Christians as a really a tool of discipleship and really a tool for helping the poor. We can pray for these women and children and others in the developing world. We can give our money. We can give our time. But we can also advocate on their behalf. And what that looks like is we work particularly with leaders, but every voice counts. So everyone is a contributor to this. But in working with leaders across the evangelical spectrum, from athletes to actors to pastors and authors and folks like yourself, we have them sign letters in support of funding at the United States level, federal funding, for global health and development. So your listeners may or may not know that the majority of Americans, over 50% of Americans, think that we give about 28% of our U.S. budget to foreign assistance. But that is a huge myth. In fact, we give less than 1% of our U.S. budget to international affairs or foreign assistance. So less than a penny to every dollar goes to global health and development. And of that funding, we fund things like healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies, nutrition, access to antiretrovirals for those with HIV and AIDS, bed nets for malaria, TB medications, and the list goes on for those in the developing world around these critical issues. So it's a very small amount of money, but that small amount of money is so important to save the lives of millions and millions and millions of people. I mean, one huge stat I can give you is that when I started doing this advocacy work in 2002, less than 50,000 people in Africa had access to antiretrovirals for HIV and AIDS. But today, thanks to the United States leadership and tax dollars, we provide funding for over 22 million people around the world who have HIV and AIDS. That's 22 million people who are alive because of U.S. leadership in foreign assistance. And again, this is less than 1% of our U.S. budget. So these pennies are some of the best money we spend, and it's really critical, not just kind of a moral reason, though that is the impetus for the work we do and the evangelicals that work with us. But these are also national security issues. It's important to keep these civil societies healthy so that we can work hand-in-hand in diplomatic ways with countries that might otherwise be terrorist breeding grounds, frankly. So there's a lot of reasons for this, and it's a very minuscule amount of money. But it's important to lift your voice. And by doing that, all you have to do is call your congressman or your senator and let them know that you support funding for maternal and child health and global health issues. It's that simple. It takes 30 seconds. And your leadership is just absolutely critical for upholding this funding.
Okay, friends, if you want to know more about you want more information, or you want more information on how you can become an advocate, I would recommend, first of all, the Mother and Child Project book, because in the back it actually has resources and sample letters for you to follow. You also get a really good sense of all of the people who are engaged and involved. You can start by going to hopethroughhealinghands.org. That's hopethroughhealinghands.org. You can get all the information there. You can sign up for the newsletter and all kinds of other good stuff. All right, Jenny Dyer, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
And thank you for having me, Carmen. It was a pleasure.
All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge.
But I know we're gonna make it. I know we're gonna get there soon.
Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. This is the point in the show where we like to make the connecting point. My connecting point today is really, it's a news item for those of you who have not yet heard. Certainly, if you are in our Faith 93.1 or 1090 listening area in Waterloo, Iowa, you are certainly already aware of this. If you guys have been tracking the headline news of the day across the country, you're already aware of this as well. And this is the news related to Molly Tibbetts. So although the press is simply reporting that that a body has been found in the search for Molly Tibbetts, her dad is actually reporting that Molly has been found dead. And so we certainly want to, I know it's profoundly heartbreaking. And so we want to be lifting up this family, and we want to be grieving with those who grieve. We want to be righteously angry with this family and with this community and with the friends of Molly Tibbetts. We want to be certainly thinking about and praying for all of those students as they return to the University of Iowa without their classmate this year. We want to grieve with those who grieve. We want to acknowledge that the people in the little town of Brooklyn, Iowa, who up until this point have never locked their doors, now say we lock our doors every night. So we don't want fear to reign. We want peace and justice to roll down. And so those are some of the prayers that I want us to communally be lifting up in the face of this news. Certainly we want to be praying that the perpetrator be found. I've already heard one person reflect that, you know, this is every parent's worst nightmare. And it occurs to me that every parent's worst nightmare has lots of variations. Every parent's worst nightmare is kind of variations on a theme. This is one of them, that your child would be abducted, that you would spend moments that turn into hours, that turn into days, that turn into weeks, in this case, that turned into a month. But for other parents out there, this nightmare goes on. Their children remain missing and their whereabouts unknown, and whether or not they are alive or dead. And so when we talk about every parent's worst nightmare, this is one of them. But every parent's worst nightmare has variations on a theme, and I want us to remember that today as we are praying for the Tibbetts family, as we are praying for this mom and this dad and these siblings and these friends. I want us to be remembering that there are other parents out there who, when they hear the phrase, every parent's worst nightmare, the nightmare is different. Just in the last couple of days, I've got friends in my own life who are parents who are now facing what for them is the parent's worst nightmare, a prenatal diagnosis of a grandchild who, if born, is going to be born with tremendously challenging, severe medical and mental issues. A person who shared with me that she's got a 13-year-old that is, I don't want to say that she's suicidal, but with issues that her mom does not know how to handle or deal with. And then a friend this morning in a small group that I'm in, he shared that a dear friend of his actually had a 13-year-old son who committed suicide last week. We talk about every parent's worst nightmare. It's variations on a theme. And I want us to remember that as we're praying today for parents everywhere. When I was in high school, there was like one Moms Against organization, and it was MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You guys remember MAD? MAD still exists. Mothers are still against drunk driving. But since then, You know, so now we're talking about 30 years, 30 some year period of time. Since then, the things that mothers have organized themselves against is it's an ever lengthening list. So now we don't just have MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. We have MASS, Mothers Against Student Suicide. We have Mothers Against Alcohol, bullying, child predators, addiction, abuse, eating disorders, gangs, gun violence, human trafficking, opioids, sex offenders, school shootings, texting and driving, prescription drug abuse, police violence, pit bulls, racism, Sharia. Really, anything or anyone that threatens a child now has an organized effort of moms who are against it. I mean, there are even moms aligned together against syndromes like autism. Anything that, you know, threatens our children, we've now got moms that are organized against it. Well, why is that? It's because moms are for kids. That's sort of the nature of what being a mom is all about. So as we pray today for moms and dads, as we pray today for this family of Molly Tibbetts, and we recognize the devastation that they are experiencing, and we think to ourselves, this is every parent's worst nightmare. I just want us to widen the scope of those prayers and recognize that for some parents, every parent's worst nightmare is whatever their nightmare was with their kid. Maybe it was, you know, the diagnosis of childhood leukemia. You know, some of these things are no longer a death sentence, but for some people they still are. And so I want us to be mindful of that. Every parent's worst nightmare is whatever the nightmare is that those parents experience. And so let's just be mindful today of the gift and brevity of life, of the precious nature of children. And specifically, let's be praying today for the parents of Molly Tibbetts, for her friends, for her fellow University of Iowa students, for the faculty there, for the faith communities in each one of these places, which will, you know, now really need to be places of not only sanctuary, but the processing of the big why questions that always come. Let's be praying for the people of the community where she was, where she lived and where she was abducted. And let's also pray for justice. I mean, we worship the God who, one of the names God reveals himself is Elroy. So Elroy means the God who sees. And anytime that you think somebody is getting away with something, I want you to remember that God reveals himself, among all his other names, God reveals himself as the God who sees. Nobody is ultimately getting away with anything. Nobody is ultimately getting away with murder. Nobody is ultimately getting away from acting like a predator toward a child. Nobody, regardless of their rank or status or title in this life, nobody is getting away with that, because we worship the God who sees, Elroy. The same God whose justice rolls down like mighty water. And so I'm going to pray that right now God would actually convict the perpetrator of their sin. That's going to be my prayer. My prayer is that the God who sees would right now reveal to the perpetrator of this crime that that person is seen, that justice is real, and that they're not getting away with this. Let's be praying that law enforcement would be able to identify this perpetrator should this person not come forward and confess their sin. But let me be bold to say, in our listening area, you might be listening right now. And so let me say to you, if you're the person or persons responsible for this, God sees. And it's time for you to come forward and confess. Confession's not just good for the soul. Confession is good for the restoration of the community. Let's be praying in that way. All right, friends, that is all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You can always visit me online, myfaithradio.com. My ministry website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com, and hit me up on Twitter @CarmenLaBerge. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.